There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 814.
What do you have on your...
I got two things. So first of all, I want to promote somebody. I got this email. Hey, I saw this on Reddit that there's an email for email at events at Nerdist.com. Where do I put my events? Well, Chris Tisdale, you found it.
So he emailed
events, the email to ask where to email.
Events at Nerdist.com and said, where do I
I've
email
never
events?
Put that much effort into anything.
Well, Chris, you found the place.
You sure did.
So now we just promoted your thing.
Yeah.
Your thing was the email you sent.
I have wanted to throw out, I've been producing the Jackie and Laurie show on Nerdist Network.
Yes.
And I think it might be one of the best. If you're a comedian and you're not listening to the Jackie and Laurie show, you're fucking up stand-up. Because it is amazing. It is two people with 60 years worth of stand-up experience between the two of them talking about stuff. And they just got their own Twitter account to be able to interact with people. It's Jackie at Jackie and Laurie. And hit them up, because my God, like, it's been really neat to watch that podcast grow and become like a cool thing that's both an amazing resource and also a very unique perspective in stand-up to listen to. And so I recommend it heartily.
Thank you, Kyle.
And I would also recommend the podcast What Did You Learn? It is a little independent podcast by Monica Scott, who is a producer around town. She's worked on a million shows. It's her and Luke Jensen, and they watch a documentary every week and figure out what can they glean from these things.
What types of documentaries?
They've gone everywhere. I did the American Scream on it about the Home Haunters. They have a great one on the Thin Blue Line. They have a really great one on Zeitgeist, where it's just this crazy breakdown of like conspiracy theories as a part of like national consciousness. Phenomenal show.
Great.
So those are little things out in the corkboard world.
Thank you very much, Kyle, for bringing us the Nerdist Community Corkboard. We'll put K's on that for Kyle.
Let's not do that, because it's Kyle's Community Corkboard at some point there, and we don't want that at all.
No,
we don't want that at all.
Accidentally.
No. Let's keep them nice and C-like. You don't need those hard consonants to be that well defined.
C for Chris.
Yeah.
C for Chris. Not K for Kyle or Katie.
No.
Definitely not. C for
we
Chris.
Are. The K's are full for this show.
Sorry. Two's the limit. No room for a third. Just catch the next bus.
Yeah.
Third K. Catch the next one. This episode is Dana Carvey, who was fucking awesome. God, he was great.
I just kept looking at him going, you're Dana Carvey.
Well, and we're...
if you're listening to these hot and fresh out of the oven,
yeah,
then you should come to Meltdown tonight for a real special show called Beta Test.
Yeah, we're doing Beta Test. It's a new material show tonight. Myself, Nikki Glaser's going to be on the show, and Dana Carvey. Now, normally I don't give out the guests, because I want people just to come to see the show and not have it be contingent upon who's there. There's always a...
You're all the attraction they need,
fun,
Chris.
That's not true.
They're just delicious, hilarious icing.
But Dana's pretty extra special, and he's promoting The Secret Life of Pets. That is in theaters July 8th. You should absolutely go see it. Other folks are in that movie you might know.
What if comedians were dogs is the original title of that movie.
What if Louis C.K. was in an animated dog movie? There's that too. So Dana Carvey, Secret Life of Pets, July 8th, number 814 with Mr. Dana Carvey. Katie, would you be so kind?
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Like, we're kind of doppelgangers. What's your background? Scottish? Norwegian?
It is an Anglo-Mutt.
Yeah.
It's largely Scottish and Northern English on my dad's side.
Scottish. I've got a McDonald. Carvey is from County Sligo, Irish, and then I've got a lot of Scandinavian.
Yeah, Norwegian, Hardwick and McCrory was right. was that genetic soup.
Yeah.
But then my mom's Italian and her mother was half Indian, Native American.
Interesting.
Have you gotten a 23andMe? Have you spit in a tube yet?
No, I've not spit in a tube yet. I'm really, I don't know.
I did it. A lot of fun.
What'd you find out?
I found out I've got some Native American.
Yep.
I've got 9% cool. West African.
What?
Yeah. And then the rest of it is a Spanish, Portuguese, Italian.
Yeah, there it is. I see.
So
it.
This is that accurate? Do you believe in that? I mean, is it accurate?
I think it's pretty accurate.
My wife also did it. She is 98.8% Ashkenazi Jew.
this was your dream.
Ashkenazi? I didn't even know there was that many. What's an Ashkenazi?
Yeah,
sorry,
it's like a Gentile. I assume it's the northern.
Oh, okay.
The northern Jews.
You know, this is very exciting for Matt because what you don't know about Matt is that Matt tried to convert to Judaism as a child because to be in comedy you had to be Jewish. Mm. So he legit tried to convert.
Yeah, my mother
from
got me
what?
The book.
From Catholic?
Catholicism, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Found out it was too much work.
Wow. Yeah.
Gave up on it and then just married a super Jewish lady.
I like Judaism myself. I was raised Lutheran, which is very, you know.
Yeah.
No one really believed, even the pastor. You know what I mean? We knew it was very light. Maybe it's true. You know?
But I mean, it's, you know.
Every sermon was delivered with a wink.
Yeah. Even our hymns were agnostic. This is a bit. Jesus, Son of God, or just a nice guy? Bump, bump, sorry. I didn't want to do shtick.
No, please, shtick it up.
So do doing, okay, let me do Donald Trump. Are we on the podcast?
This is happening already.
Let me tell you something. I just do them very feminine. I don't know why. I had to pick an angle. You know, just a little bit of moisture. There's a very, very touchy kind of... It's up here. People say I don't like China. I love China. I love China. He's really more yelling on top now, if you see him, right? Yeah, these people are crazy. These people are nuts. He's up there a lot, you know? And then he's down here, and he's very... Oh, Regis, let me tell you something. Strahan couldn't take the heat. I'm ready to go. So what? I don't use the Grecian formula. I can't be on television.
I heard
I'm like
Regis,
Santa Claus on top.
Okay. I heard Regis get very angry once, and it was very upset. It was very off-putting. A friend of mine was working on Millionaire, and so I went to a taping, and his mic was on at a commercial break. And I don't know what he was angry about, but his mic was still on, and I just heard, what? Let's just do the fucking thing! And it's like, and it went out over the whole, and then just instantly, like, his mic cut out, and there was that... There was that moment in a room where you can just, you know, it's like everything, all the air just got sucked out for a second, but they never, obviously they didn't address
it. I was on one of those shows. I felt the tension from me. It's like that Casey Kasem one where he went, which is the
classic.
Ultimate. But Coming Regis being mad at you would be very intense. What the fuck is your problem? You understand? The key to him is just kind of holding your nose, I guess. And, it's such a classic voice, isn't it?
Regis? His voice. Yeah, his voice too.
It's kind of like a vaudevillian. It's sort of like Groucho Marx slowed down
a little bit.
Pick a ticket, one divided duck among you. Pick a ticket, one divided duck among you.
I feel like
understand
there was,
what I'm talking. It's very classic.
I feel like there was there was the kind of that old idea of like if you're going to be a broadcaster, you have to be able to talk like this.
You know, good,
like,
with a little Rod
Serling. A little bit of this, in there, and you need to enunciate your words.
Yeah, you know? And it's kind of funny when you talk like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, it is funnier.
Because I referred to it once. I was talking to Michael. Well, the character of Reedy, because it's very interesting you say that. We talked to him, but he's like his character. You know, I put all, you know, I'm sad, everybody's mad at me, and this kind of thing. Anyway, I could do him all day long. I'd much rather be him than
me. It actually underscores this much bigger idea that your impersonations, which sort of became almost bigger than the people that you were caricaturizing, it wasn't even that they always sounded exactly like the person, but you were able to extract some essential quality of that person.
Thank you.
And that made it... More than if it was like a, you know.
Oh, it became the zeitgeist. So then everybody was doing not Carson. They were doing Dana Carvey's version of
exactly.
Carson, etc.
Well, I don't have the gifts of like Frank Caliendo. Some of it was a little bit of fakery. You know? Here's one thing I do that I was surprised to try to get to the essence of Trump since this is Nerdcast. Nerdist, whatever it's called. Anyway, Trump is like a Batman villain to me. Because, you know, it's Trump on his helicopter, his airplane, the giant orange head.
Yeah.
I'm going to say he's like a video game character. Like, if he's president, his head will get bigger and oranger as he gets more power.
Yes, I agree.
But this is Trump as a Batman villain. Trump, you'll never get wait, you'll never get away with this, Trump. You know, I think I will. Okay. And then they never get this part of it. He goes, you know why? From now on, you can call me Trump God. Now, you're the only guy who's ever laughed at that. Every time I go that that's his name, his moniker, Trump card, it plays the silence.
Well, you because you, number one, you have to understand what the old Batman, structure of the Batman yeah. villain is like.
Ice.
He's got to have a character. He's got to have the pun on the name. And so the people that you've been telling that joke to, they're fucking wrong.
Yeah,
can
wrong
I do a – here's a current Johnny Carson thing I do just
please.
To amuse my friends. So this is just – Johnny Carson being pulled over on the PCH and admitting where he was drinking, the name of the establishment, and the name of the drink. And that's all you need to know.
Well, I'm sorry, officer. I didn't know I was swerving. I had two slippery midgets at the Hook and Crook.
Right? What is better than that? Like, that's all I need in life.
Let him go. Let him go.
That's it. I had two frozen soldiers at the Windy Summit.
Just the, I don't know, the drinks and the
It's great that you, it's interesting that you brought that up because I was just watching a video today. Someone on, I can't remember which side it was, but it was the time that Johnny Carson kind of bombed famously in 1991. Morrissey was a guest. And Bill Cosby was also on. Which
I was reading that.
You read that article?
Yeah.
So Morrissey was so super famous in this super famous underground to the extent where he could sell out arenas. He was selling out the Forum. He was selling out these arenas. But he got no airplay, and the general public had no idea who he was. So you had Bill Cosby and Beau Bridges on, and Carson didn't realize that – all Morrissey fans filled his audience. So they just didn't want
totally
a shred of Carson.
Yeah.
And it's 91, so he's about to leave anyway.
Yeah.
And just the resignation of him like giving up to the audience and bombing and trying to make himself laugh. And it was really interesting to see him squirm that far into his career.
Yeah, it was interesting. Once I was on there sitting next to Johnny, I guess I was the first guest out. I only went on maybe six times. And Kennison went out and started going off, like off script. And Johnny, I could hear him under his breath going, oh, Sham, don't do it, Sham. It's so interesting, right? So emotional.
Did you ever hang out with him?
With Sam? Like,
no, with Sam,
with
Johnny. With
Johnny,
yeah.
I was terrified. I would say two things terrified me the most in my career. Besides auditioning for SNL, but the first time I was in 8H and Lovitz, who was already on the show and was a big star, the liar, you know, and Don Pardo was there and he goes, say Dana's name. This was before I was on the show. Dana Carvey. That was just like, but I would say being behind that curtain and hearing that voice. A gentleman joins us. I'll never forget. He had a bit of success on Saturday Night Live with a character called the Churchley. will you please welcome Dana Garno? Dun, dun, dun. So I was always just too frightened to even. Once that giant Carson head was that close to me, and I could see all the booze and cigarettes and sun damage, I was completely.
Did he ever acknowledge?
No, it was pre-4K. It was just, you know, it was very blurry television.
No, but did he acknowledge your version of him?
Oh, totally. Well, I would go on, you know, I would go on and do it for him a little bit, and he would laugh. And he was okay. Like, he loved Carsenio. We did one where it combined.
Carsenio, yes.
And I did a benefit with Arsenio the other night. We were talking about that. And he liked that. He apparently said, well, they're making fun of Arsenio and me, so it seems fine, you know. But then there was one that we did that did kind of like it, that was sort of it. I wasn't asked back.
Really? What was it?
There was one where, well, Smigel had written it. It was sort of that Susan Day was on and Johnny didn't know the Partridge Family was off.
It's a delightful show.
And then Chris Rock came out as, I think, Arsenio. And then Johnny was saying, so your ratings have gone up and ours have gone down. Is that right? So it was just, he was a little senile. And I remember thinking this one might have crossed the line. And but I let myself get talked into it.
It was probably the thing about ratings, because he obviously, I think he had probably an incredible ego about that stuff. I mean, just hearing the Joan Rivers things about, once she did that other show, he never spoke to her again. I mean, he obviously and any of the stuff that I've read or seen about him, he obviously... There was obviously some darkness swimming around in there. Like, he didn't...
Well, going back full circle real quickly, when Regis told me a long story, but long story short, he went over there and he was at Johnny's studio. He did the show. And then afterwards, he was joking around. They go, Johnny likes you. You should come for dinner. So this is Regis telling me, so Johnny likes me. We're going to have friends now, right? So they're somewhere in Santa Monica or some restaurant, and Regis... His rental car, he gets lost. He even had one of those giant phones in it, a brick phone. I can't, where the hell am I? Where's the 405? You understand? And so he came late, and he's, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And Carson just didn't acknowledge him the whole time. And then when they're getting the valet in the car, he just goes, yeah, it was, you know, I couldn't find it. I was lost, you know. And Carson just goes, you're a funny guy. You're a funny guy. That was it.
That was it.
That was it. He was late to the dinner.
Oh, shit. Yeah, there is. I think that is like, wow. I think there's probably like he probably lived by some old, weird,
yeah,
like alpha male code.
Oh, totally.
From the 50s and 60s. It was just, you could, there were certain lines. You, if you crossed them, that was it.
Going to adopt that.
You don't want to adopt that.
A woman who was a physical fitness trainer for my wife and I in the 90s, she dated Johnny. In the 80s, when he was maybe in between marriages, and mm-hmm. he was 55 and she was 25, and her nickname was The Body. She was 40 then, but she looked amazing. And so I put her in touch with Bill Zemme, who's still finishing up the Carson the Magnificent or some giant opus on Johnny. Anyway, you wouldn't want to hear about that.
We
want to
hear every detail.
This is a lot. There's a Secret Life of Pets person over there.
We'll get to it. We'll get to it.
Anyway, he was like that. So,
well, I think the first time I remember becoming aware of you, obviously because of SNL. But then you were in a movie called Tough Guys that Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas.
Can you believe it?
But you played a totally straight. You were sort of like they were the.
Well, I just auditioned, and then freakily they said they wanted me to do it because I would go for 100 auditions,
right?
And I would go in a room and see boyish looking guys with weak chins. You know, when you're auditioning for a movie, you see what you look like when you go in. You know? But actually, I went up against Matthew Broderick for War Games. We were the final two guys testing. I tested for risky. When I was 26, I looked 18, so I could read for all those parts. But I got the part, and then I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if my character, because my character is their parole officer, they get out of prison after 30, that I worship them and I start sounding and talking and dressing like them. So that was the idea. And then the director, Jeff Canoe, ran it by Disney, and they go, no, we just wanted to play it sweet and straight.
Oh, Jeff Canoe directed Revenge of the Nerds.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he, because, well, I have two weird connections around Jeff Canoe. Were you in that movie?
No, I just was a fan of it.
Okay. Two Jeff Canoe things. I go to New York in 1980 to do my first show with Mickey Rooney and Nathan Lane.
Yes.
Okay. So that's a whole weird thing. And I'm in Rockefeller Center, and I'm, again, playing the straight man, because I always played the straight man. You know, Mickey Rooney, the first day, goes, you're the straight man, right at the read-through. And he had a .38 revolver. He carried a loaded weapon with him and would put it on the table. I was the number one star in the world. You hear me? Bang. The world. And that's exactly how we said it hundreds of times every day. I was the number one star in the world. You hear me? Bang.
Just in case you forgot.
The world. So SNL was upstairs, and I would go up and watch Piscopo and Eddie Murphy rehearse and stuff. And and thinking, oh, God, could I be up there rather than stuck in this thing? And I rented an apartment, and they said Robert Redford edited Ordinary People in this apartment. I go, well, what do you mean? Well, that's impossible. So I found out later, I met Jeff Canoe. He was the editor on Ordinary People with Redford. So I go, well, where did you edit that? Well, in this, he rented this funny little apartment on Lexington in Manhattan. So,
oh, that's crazy. I didn't know Jeff Canoe was like...
That's the first one. And then Robin Williams called me up. Jeff Canoe was attached to Dead Poets Society. Mm-hmm. So Robin called me up. Hello, some friends. Yes, but God rest his soul. But I know you did a thing with Jeff Canoe, you know, Tough Guys. What do you think? So I said, well, I think, you know, I don't know. I just kind of hedged on that one. So he waited. And then Peter Weir picked it up.
Right.
So.
And then that worked out okay.
Everybody was happy.
Everyone was happy.
But I like Jeff Canoe. Yeah.
But you, you were, I went to UCLA, and I was the president of what was a small group of people that were the comedy club. Like, we would write stand-up mm-hmm. once a week. And you came and spoke at Ackerman Union, which is our big ballroom. And and I remember getting up and terrified, was like, would you ever do a stand-up show? And you had such a great – I mean, the answer was no, but it was such a brilliant way. You were like, well, you know, I just got to be careful. I can't – if someone just gets up and says, hey, come be in a show, I might end up in the back of a van. And you kind of acted out this whole thing, which gorgeously kind of got you out of it gracefully. But what a horrible
and out of his van
for years, like, and then when I got older and I started working, I'm like, well, yeah, of course. If I just get up and go, hey, come do a show, you're not going to go, everyone, I'll be right back, and then you walk off stage and do the show.
Yeah, you get into that mode of being sort of just, I'm sorry, I can't, or whatever.
Right,
it is sort of. I mean, you must have people requesting. All the time.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah, can Chris come there? Could he? We just
would really love it if he could.
Well, it never
could
gets
he?
To Chris.
It doesn't really get to you. You have a layer of people.
He's got a couple layers you got to get through.
That's interesting.
Peel back the onion, Chris.
It's not. Matt, you're inventing a mythos which is not accurate in any way.
They're robots. He has robots.
I love it.
But I always...
Yeah, go ahead.
I always loved it. I don't know. It just always seems like, oh, when you see people... I think one of the reasons why is that you always seemed very approachable and likable.
So did you.
But I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's true.
About you or about me?
About me. About you. I always think that's... I think you seem like one of those guys who are like... And I wonder if... Does that ever kind of... was it ever almost kind of weird for you because people feel so familiar with you that they come up and obviously, I'm sure, the do this character, do that. No, come on, do it. Come on. You know, like, how do you navigate the familiarity that people have?
I try in a given moment if I'm cranky. I mean, for the George Bush Sr., I have the running joke. Will you do George Bush Sr.? And I go, not gonna do it. So they go, oh, my God.
And you get out of it, too.
My basic nature being the five kids, for whatever reason, there was a lot of violence and stuff in my childhood. So I like things calm. I don't really like confrontation. Very passive-aggressive, people-pleaser. But I'm aware of that, so I'm not so much anymore.
Right.
But when I first started getting some fame, I was exhausted. Walking around New York and doing and interacting, and everyone wanted to have a little story with me. And you know, by the time I got back to my apartment, I was exhausted. I mean, for me personally, fame was not easy. It was very distortive. Like five kids, three older brothers, younger sister. So my mom had the pictures on the fridge of all the kids. And then as I got more famous, would come home for Thanksgiving, there'd just be more and more pictures of me, and the other ones would be taken off.
Rightfully so.
I know. Well, that made me happy. That's the good part of the story. I wanted to dominate that Sears point.
A little bit of room over here. I noticed you couldn't put one extra picture down there.
I guess I'm approachable. I don't know. Maybe I'm a nice guy. I always feel like I'm a mean guy underneath and a nice guy on top. And Dennis Miller, they think, is mean on top, but he's really nice inside. Thanks, Carvey, laying me out at the Nerd Podcast. What's the Hardwick kid like, huh? Heard he did some stand-up at the La Brea Improv, huh? Who was the middle, Bill Nicknick? Christ, podcast, Carvey. Christ, there's no money in it. Get on a real network.
Bill Nicknick.
Let's start getting into Dennis. My vocabulary increases when I do Dennis.
You can't, and they're nonsensical words, even to Dennis.
He, when you talk to him, yeah, he has a Rolodex in his brain. He absolutely is ridiculous with wordsmith and wordplay. Just crazy. And you get into that mode, and everything is to that sausage factory of kind of critical. Okay, good. Darth Vader wallpaper, huh? Okay, got the street kid with the nerds. Okay. Good luck at Comic-Con.
It's all rhythm. It's all
intonation. A rhythm.
It's
yeah, it almost intonation. Doesn't matter what
doesn't
he
matter
says.
Doesn't matter what he's saying.
I'll be at Doral, okay? You know, it doesn't... What do you mean? What's Doral? It doesn't matter. It's all the superiority.
He's already walking away. I don't even know. I didn't even get to question it.
But he and I flying together a lot from New York back to L.A. was just because we were both just terrified, totally paranoid flyers.
Uh-huh.
So it was a very much running gags of like, Carvey, you see anything, I want to be the first to know. It's like we're on a military mission.
If you see something, say something.
Yes, exactly. And this big thing that Dennis would always do, this cliche from war movies, you're without a doubt the raggediest bunch of losers, laziest bunch of know-nothings I've ever had the pleasure to command. And that was our running gag, which I love. You know, he is funny. He is funny.
I wasn't that long ago. I watched because I watched all the young comedians. I watched every stand up comedy, everything when there was the comedy boom.
Mm-hmm.
And you had hosted one of the young comedian specials, which I think maybe like I think Ray Romano might have been on the
he
one.
He was.
And Judd.
Judd, Ray,
and
Jeanine Garofalo,
Kindler. I think
Kindler was on it,
and Bill Bellamy, maybe.
I'm gonna throw him in. Yeah,
no, let's throw him in there.
Like I've known so many people that are net worth between $1 and $400 million. I mean, that I knew them when they had a ham sandwich. I mean, you know, Will Ferrell. You just add them up. I mean, it is extraordinary. The amount of people I know that are between 100 million net and 400 million. Because I'm a detail person. In my head, I'm thinking, I'm giving you 40.
You're giving me 40?
Well, I'm giving you 40 million net.
Me poor person?
I don't know. It seems like I got an empire.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
You know,
he's
know.
Doing all right.
Things are...
I'm giving you $3 million.
Very generous. Thank you, Dana.
But anyway, everyone goes on celebrity worth. We could look you up, but... You know,
I don't even know. Oh, yeah. I don't want to look it up. I don't want to know. Because if it's low, I'll be like, oh, that's all I... And if it's too high, I'll be like, oh, my God. I have a lot of
work to do. When I hear, you know, Seinfeld at $800 million net, I'm thinking, well then did he make $2.5 billion? I mean, I'm not a hedge fund guy. I mean...
Yeah,
you keep about 35%.
Yes.
I mean, how do you get to a billion?
Oh, if you're lucky, if you want to make a shit ton of money, you have to make a fuck ton of money, like because so many pieces of it go to other,
which is fine,
totally fine.
Not complaining, but you just want to be realistic. If you hear someone makes $1 million, you know they're making 400 if
right.
they're lucky, which is a incredible amount of money.
Yeah,
but to get 800 million net, did Jerry make $2.5 billion?
Well, they got a billion
gross
first syndication deal of Seinfeld.
But gross or net? I could talk about this all day. I'm into finance.
People skimming off the top.
So he's netting 400.
But then there was another syndication deal after that one expired.
Oh yeah,
it was like 2.1.
But then
billion.
All that money is probably in just crazy investment funds
that just yeah.
I mean, it's like you know when Bill from the time Bill Gates left Microsoft,
right.
was actually where he's made the majority of his wealth. I mean, he went from a net worth of probably
yeah.
somewhere around 10 billion to like 80. From the time he left, because just he was just investing all that money in stuff.
I know. That's the way capitalism works.
That's the way it all
That's
works.
That's the way it works.
Jerry
it just
keeps
ramps
it all
up.
In small bills in the glove compartment of Porsches.
They're just hidden around the
hanger.
They're just hidden around.
And he only tells Jay Leno where the money is.
Yeah, okay. It's a Ford Fairlane, 65. Yeah, take a look at it. Yeah.
Why would you do anything else when you could do a stand-up? You know what I'm saying? Oh, yeah, go to a birthday party when you could be doing stand-up somewhere. I mean, he is.
Why would you go to a birthday party?
You could be doing that. I mean, he is.
You
can Jay
perform
is,
at the birthday party.
I mean, Jay is such a purist. I mean, nobody loves it like Jay.
Well, and yeah. and he, I met him. I did Real Time about a year and a half ago, and he was on. And seeing backstage the Jay that I remembered from when he used to go on Letterman.
Yeah.
Just seeing the real acerbic, you know, someone's yeah. like, are you sad to leave the Tonight Show? And backstage was like, well, I'm not interviewing A-head celebrities anymore. Why would I? I was like, oh, okay.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's that guy.
Right. Well, he's a scientist about it. I mean, he was just, you know, yeah, I do, you know, whatever. I do 29 jokes. It's 13 minutes. Dave does 6 minutes. No, it's okay. You know, I mean, he has it down to the minute Jay had the tonight. He just understood the network dealings of it. Anyway.
We're a quirky bunch. The comedians are a quirky bunch.
We're a quirky little bunch. Are we, you know, where do you lay on that, the spectrum of needing it? Like, do you need to get on stage or do you go on because you have some funny ideas or do you, like, get oxygen from it? I mean, there's two different types, really.
It's a little bit of both. I think I just...
Interesting.
I like it. I like it. I enjoy
I'm
it.
I'm lowering your net worth based
yeah,
on what
no,
you just said.
No, I need it. If I don't do it for a while, I do need to get on stage.
Yeah.
But I'm not... I don't feel obsessive about it in the sense that... If I don't perform 7 times this week,
yeah.
I am not a comedian. I like it. I like performing. I like being in front of people. I obviously crave attention. And it's fun. It's something that I hope I will never not do. And it's why I ever did anything was just so I could get people out to see shows.
Well, if you do stand-up, then you are doing a lot of things at once. You know, conquering fear, the most humiliating things in my life have been some of my bombs.
Yeah. You know? What's your worst bomb story?
Westwood Comedy Store, George Slaughter. I'd only done stand-up 2 years from Laugh-In. Came to San Francisco to recruit for that short-lived second Laugh-In
yep.
show, which Robin Williams got on. and saw me at a little teeny place called the Mustard Seed Cafe, and I got on a roll with my Star Trek bit, he invited me to L.A. to meet, you know. So, well, this is the first part of the bomb. My parents bought me a corduroy suit. We're from Northern California, so I was sweating the entire time. I was a three-piece corduroy suit that was light beige. I'm walking around like urban cowboy or something. And I went in his office, and I thought it was a regular job, and he was trying to get me to be funny, and I was just totally like that. So then he goes, well, we got Sean at the Westwood Comedy Store. So I went over there, and I'm on kind of early, and I went up, and I did my first Star Trek thing and played to silence, and I had no experience to like mayday switch, talk to the audience, anything. So I just went down in sweaty flames, just the worst ever. And I went over to the booth, and I had a girlfriend at the time who was sitting there, and I sat next to her, and everyone could see us, and I'm just drenched in sweat, just really shooken up, and she scooched over. And then they threw up J.J. Walker, who was going to go on an hour later, just so I wouldn't walk the room, because people were starting to go, this is so bad, I'm getting out of here. So he goes, take a look, kid, and see how it's done. So that was my worst bump.
Did he crush? Wow.
He crushed. And he was great. He was absolutely great.
But that's the thing. If you can still get on stage, because everyone has one of those types of stories, and if you can still get on, that's when I tell people, like, if you can still get on stage after that happens and you still want to get on stage, you're probably doing the right thing, because that would make most people never do it again.
I would get wounded and quit for like 2 months.
Yeah.
Because I took everything personally. I didn't know till later, because both my kids are now stand-ups in their early 20s. I'm down here mentoring them. I tell them it's mostly circumstantial. You know, I would play like people would be eating at some party and I'm doing stand-up and I'm bombing. And I would take it really personal. Because when you first start out, you're like, really? Like, I'm going to do this? Seriously? Me? I mean, I may be a professional comedian. So you need so much validation the first 3 years. And yeah, I got just so wounded and I had horrible stage fright. Horrible.
Was your early stand-up, was it a lot of character stuff or was it more jokey jokes?
Well, because I was playing dick bars, I would do just really quick. I did, my first bit was the X-rated Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was horrible stuff. I'd get hard and I'd have foreplay. I'd even have some more play if I only had a dick. Da-dun, da-dun-dun-dun. That was a big closer.
You got to bring it back, Dana.
It could be. I can see
you got to bring it back.
The Twitterverse is going to light up on that one. But then later on, I got to the other cafe. Did you ever go through there? That little, it was a little place in the Haight-Ashbury, San Francisco.
I know it. No, yeah. Yes, I definitely know it, but I never did it.
And that's where I kind of realized the entire time I was a sketch player doing stand-up. It's even what I'm dealing with now. I just shot a special for Netflix, and I did it in a fairly big room, and but I was warming up in small clubs, so all my bits were very small, little character. I do Charming Hitler. Just that Hitler was always screaming when we see him. Yeah. That he must have been exhausted to the point of being almost effeminate backstage. And he would be manipulative. Himmler, so stealthy, so secretive. Everyone loves your haircut, but no one knows who your baba is. So I'm in a 1,000-seat theater, this small, playing like this, so I've learned that I need to play smaller rooms.
How do you balance out when you – because so many characters that you've created are so iconic as part of our pop culture. I mean, a lot of them. And so when you go on stage, you must feel like
– Edwin Harry comes to mind.
I love that one. Edwin Harry.
Lyle the effeminate heterosexual.
That's a good problem to have, but it is a real problem.
Because people want to – because then at that point, it almost is like people are almost seeing you like a band. Or like, do this one. You're like, no, but I got to do new stuff. I have to create new things that you will want to see. So how do you balance that?
It's a real problem. The first thing I said to John Irwin, who was the producer of the special.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, John.
And I just said, well, can we do it? Can I do it in front of not my audience? You know, because I did a thing with Spade in front of Spade's audience, and I was just doing much better. So when I did it with my real fans that are, you know, a lot of snow on the roof, a little older, I get it. And I totally understand what they're looking for. And everybody's always been a little confused as to who am I? I mean, am I a G-rated sort of Carol Burnetti type, or the stuff that I've done over the years is a little confusing. So I think I did hurt their feelings a little bit on some of the specials. I mean, sometimes I get people looking like they're in pain with some of the stuff I'm doing. And I'll toss in a little bit of Garth, and I'll toss in a little bit of Church Lady. You know, I get that. But it's a good problem to have, but it's definitely a problem, because they would love it if I said, you know what, forget my act tonight. I've got all the costumes backstage. I'm going to do a review of all my SNL characters in costume.
Yeah.
They'd be delighted. So it's kind of an interesting thing, and I don't know the way out of it. I get a kick out of making them laugh just as hard at a new bit. You know, that's tough, though.
Because you definitely want to – you want them to be happy and comfortable. So I think it is like, well, do you do a character they know first and then do a new bit, or do you do a new bit first and then give them – it's like when I saw Beck play a couple years ago. He said at the top of the show, listen, I'm going to play like 8 songs that you don't really know, but then I'm going to play all the stuff you want to hear. And the audience seemed like he made that deal with them up front to just just so they weren't spending the whole time going, is he going to play Luther or what's happening?
You know, right. No.
Where's Devil's Haircut? So he did all that. And then at the end, he played all the songs that everyone knew. And
well, there was a little bit of a sub thing of that was like my wife was in the audience and I've known her since the 70s. So she's like, you know.
She's over it, Dave.
Completely. Which I like. I never wanted a fan because the arc of a comedian who marries a fan, then she's at every show and she's kind of in the front 2 rows, and then maybe 6 months later she's in the middle, and then 6 months later she's like at every other show,
right?
And then when she comes, she just sort of looks in for a bit and then leaves early, you know. And then eventually she's not there,
yeah.
And then they're divorced. So it
must be great being married to a comedian. It's great,
but she just said, well, they seem to really laugh every time I would switch my voice. Because I don't really have a face or a voice. I'm like an invisible. Like you could put 2 inches of prosthetic makeup on John Lovitz and go, "Hi, John, how you doing?" What? How could you tell? How did you know it was me? But I'm like working this junior Gary Oldman look where I've got a little bit of scruff and I wear these glasses. I don't really need them, and you know. So I need to create a face. I'm like the Invisible Man. So. What was I saying?
You're talking about your wife saying to you.
Oh, well,
you
they know. Just like it when I go into a voice, the audience. Even if it's not a popular character. Like if I start talking like an Italian accent, they're like, hey, he's
that's
doing
what he
it.
Does. That's
it doesn't matter. If I go like, what the fuck are you doing over here? You know, they're happy.
Well, I think that's because that's sort of the bank account that you've built up with the public is like, oh, Dana Carvey does characters, so if I see him doing a character, he's doing the thing that I expect him to do, and I can laugh at that.
And what is it about me that I keep working against that? Why don't I just go with it? Is it self-destructive?
I don't know if it's
you're on the wrong podcast.
You know what it almost might be? Is it the character?
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry.
The character stuff seems to come so easily to you. Maybe you don't consider it a real thing. Where you're like, well, that's not who I am. This is just a thing I can do. And maybe you want, you know, maybe it's that struggle between I want people to know who I am versus.
I know what you mean. I do. As I started doing this special, I realized, I do like doing the ultimate thing for me is to wind down a character and attitude and take it really, 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 really far. And that's what I would do in the back of the Volkswagen Bug with my friends in college when they were all stoned. I mean, I wouldn't do jokes or bits. I'd do an impression of the water polo coach for a half hour.
Right.
So that's what I want to do. That's why I want to do one of these shows, so I can do that.
Why don't you do that?
I want to do a podcast. I like things. I like to come into things late after they've already peaked.
Hey, that's what Apple does.
Right, and then takes it over.
Apple waits to see how something works, and then they go, okay, we're just going to tweak it this way.
Well, guys, I've just bought a DVD pressing plant.
Great idea.
I really think it's going to
make DVDs.
But the redundancy of stand-up, I find, that's where the work comes in, you know, repeating things that you've got all worked out nicely. So, I mean, don't you find that's the hardest part? When you're first coming on to a new bit, it's very exciting,
of
right?
Of course.
That's the best part of stand-up by far. And then when you've peaked with it, but you've got to get the energy up to remember. Because you know how bits sometimes start to slip away?
Sure.
You go, what happened to that bit?
Why aren't
it
they
was
responding?
My killer bit.
Because you don't buy it anymore.
Yeah.
And when you don't buy it, the audience can tell that you don't buy it anymore. So I think it's like you try new tags or you try a different spin or you fuck with the order. Or I, you know, like 40% of what I do when I'm doing a live show is just fucking around with the crowd. And then it kind of like the bits sort of weave in and out of that. So it's never the same. You would never see the exact same show twice.
Well, that's nice because then you're keeping yourself all balanced too. So,
yeah.
So if someone yells out a bit that makes me think of a bit I already have, that already makes it new. If
right.
they yell out a topic, you know, if you do Q&A with a crowd, they always lead you to some bit, old bit or something. So
yeah.
There's just ways to kind of keep it interesting. Some brilliant comedians are really wordsmith word for word and
right.
just repeat. you know.
That I feel like would be hard to do, because that is a that all that becomes like a theater performance where it's like
right.
everything has to
never
be exactly
ending.
And it never can deviate, because this is the because
mm-hmm.
then I would always feel like, oh, if someone saw this, if someone came to the 8 o'clock show and the 10 o'clock show, then the, some of the magic get, you know, jokes are magic tricks, and then it feels like some of the magic trick gets spoiled if someone sees the exact same
yeah.
thing twice in a row.
The only bit that I really liked from the special, because I've seen everything so much, was just sort of ad-lib that night. It was a bit that I did in 1983, and it was because I was a Scarface fanatic, like a lot of us. Comedians were the first ones that became fanatics yeah. of the movie, and later on the rappers,
moved over
right?
to the hip-hop industry, yeah.
But I'd done Tony Montana at Thanksgiving dinner. It was a complete abstraction, but I just improvised it that night. I kind of hatched it at the Ice House a little bit, so I was discovering it while we were shooting. And so then it just, to me, I look at it and I go, wow, the difference is so enormous. It's just really, really popping.
Did you ever hear John Mulaney's bit about Scarface?
No.
It's a great, I think it's on the top part. I think it's on the, is it on top part? But he's talking about how he hates Scarface. And then he's describing
him.
It. He goes, and,
as
and,
a real person.
Yeah, but just he hates the, it's like he doesn't understand the obsession with the movie. And he describes Scarface's house. He goes, Scarface's house looks like if the Golden Girls won the lottery.
Well, that's true.
It's a great bit. But that idea of being able to take old stuff, that's why I think it's always good to go back and look at old jokes, because like maybe they weren't ready yet, or maybe you have a different perspective that you can bring to some of your older stuff. I think, well, we write off old bits like, no, those are old, but I think it's good to...
Well, there's iconic tentpoles for me as far as rhythms that now are sort of operatic or considered over the top. And two would be... Robert Shaw and Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Shark in the water. Cage. I mean, talk about chewing scenery, but it's genius. You can never get it out of your mind. Cage in the water.
Sharks in the water. Chew more scenery than
our
the shark.
Shark in the water. Talking about a great white chiefy. 25 feet. So it's just a rhythm you could never. And then I think what Al Pacino did with the Cuban accent was artistic to me. Chorono. Chorolactis. Okay. Okay. That attitude and that rhythm is never tiring to me.
What if Scarface met Robert Shaw? I think it would.
Hello, man. What are you going to do? Catch a fish? That's what you do. You got to catch a fish? Is that your idea? Fish go in the water. Where the fuck would a fish be but in the water? Okay? Sure don't know. What are you talking about, man? What are you talking about? The thing that I started winding down for my own self is that at Thanksgiving dinner, he starts talking about how the grandmother eats all the really cool food. So I look around, man. I look for a bowl of cat corn. I look for a bowl of cat corn. I look. I go outside. I come back. There's no cat corn. It's just something about that accent saying cat corn.
Cat corn.
So, you know, we live in a world where you're supposed to do stand-up where it's kind of storytelling with jokes, confessional, I had a tumor, it's okay,
right.
That kind of thing, if it's sort of humorous. And I understand that. And then there's just doing abstract voices. There's not really much to talk about. It hits me viscerally. And that still is what I like to do the most rather than ideas. But I do stuff that's point of view stuff.
I had a tumor. No, it's okay. Like you could,
right? Yeah, I.
You could tell those stories. You could tell these really deep stories as these characters.
As Scarface, yeah.
You could do the.
Chihuahua the dollar, man. Embarrassed. You gonna probe me, right? I'm embarrassed. He's sticking. I don't lie.
That's sort of the Louisism of this. I mean, not that Louis is the only one. Speaking of Secret Life of Pets, but that not that Louis yeah. is the only one to ever do that. But he did. He was someone ushering in this wave of the last 10 years of comedy of like autobiographical, you know.
Yeah, which is brilliant. I mean, his wordplay and stuff is fantastic. So, yeah, it's just when you're at my age and where I'm at, you know, it's just this fine line between, you know, you don't want to like push outside yourself to try to be relevant.
Right.
And yet you don't want to be a goodie but an oldie kind of thing.
Right.
So I've already kind of run a lap where people are just happy for me to show up, and it's like, and I'm thinking in my headspace, I want to kill like it's 1985, and they're like, it's okay, we're just really glad you're here and everything, you know, the victory lap part of your career where,
you know, I think a lot of this stuff's in just, your head though, about like, I don't want people to think this, or I don't want to think this. I mean, I think, you know,
I'm sure
it's hard to get around all that stuff, because I think the weird, like the fame and the weird politics of the business really do cloud your judgment in a way that all centers around like where your ego is, and it's hard to get around that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think agents and managers generally are scared and kind of horrified. Like, I remember the first time I made $1 million from Saturday Night Live or something. I was like, shouldn't we kind of take a moment, you know? And it was immediately like the next move. And of course, you know, there's no sense of anything but just fear. But what I tell my kids, the last thing I try to remember to say to myself when I do stand-up is right before I go out, because sometimes you forget, oh, my number one job right now is to have fun.
Have fun, yeah, that's it.
But you can forget sometimes. You go, why was that set shitty? I forgot that I was supposed to have fun.
Yeah.
And I just got inside my head too much.
Did you talk about your surgery at all and into your stand-up? Does that ever weave in?
You know, I had, you know, the special is sort of has some kind of edgier stuff because I've got millennial kids. Push me, you should totally do that, Dad. Totally. I just do this voice thing. You should totally do that, Dad. Yeah, of course. And so he was like, talk about it. So I went to the West Side out in Santa Monica. So I talked about my surgery that got botched, which is really funny.
Right.
I started out with like, I went to the doctor. I had a double bypass and I said, well, how'd it go? And he said, well, it went great. Well, what happened? He goes, well, one of the things was connected properly. The other one was a little down on the side a little bit, but we thought it was a really good result, you know, one out of two. But my wife said, well, my wife goes, well, they feel sorry for you. But that's probably more of the older crowd, you know.
But who can relate to having such a thing?
I have no – for me, like being really funny is really hard. Like for me to go up there and sit on a stool and talk about the surgery or be confessional, totally fine. People can ask me anything. I just find it so much harder to be really, really funny consistently for an hour. And that's the challenge. I mean, that's still like a kind of a – chewy challenge, isn't it? Just to kill for an hour? You know how hard that is?
Well, I think when if you're touring a lot, how much do you tour?
I never really did a lot of it. And I'm always glad if the show is canceled. I am. If there was a black guy, it's like school. Remember when school was canceled?
Right. There was an exam.
Almost euphoria.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
I always had a love hate with it in a way.
If you did like 50 dates a year,
yeah,
the hour wouldn't feel that crazy because you're doing it so much. But yeah, to have to ramp up and then do it, oh, I got through that. Yeah, I can imagine that would feel.
Yeah, get used to it because people will ask me and they'll probably ask you, how do you guys do that? I go, well, we just do it a lot, you know. You could do it.
Well, we're broken, and you know, we figured it out. I think you of all people could experiment with talking about really heavy things, just doing characters, talking about the surgery.
Yeah,
maybe just to, because then it kind of has that Simpsons quality of like, oh, there's something silly happening up here, and then something deep underneath that is sneaking into people's heads.
It would be a real challenge, yeah, because people kind of glaze over when I talk about it,
right?
You know, because there's a sense that if I say, look, there's two kinds of people who had my issue, the ones who had a heart attack and ones who didn't, and I didn't. And they, once they hear that, they just go, you know.
Do you think it's because they go, this is not the Dana Carvey I want to see. I want to see the characters.
Well, it's that, and all humans want to think that illness is self-created, and it's pretty much you're a stress bucket, and it was in your head, because therefore then they can't get it.
Right.
So it's a comforting thing. So when I was up in Marin County, which is very healing crystals, and I went to a heart group after the thing, and they just said, yeah, it's pretty much in your mind. So it's like, oh, I have the power to block my own artery. Wow. Because I was stressed or whatever.
Yeah.
Then I came to Cedars-Sinai and met with P.K. Shah, who's this brilliant Indian cardiologist who's like a really good friend of mine. And he laughed. I go, is it mental? Oh, no. He doesn't like to believe in anything that he can't prove.
Right.
You know, he says, of course, stress is an influence. But I had a thing called familial hypercholesterolemia. And so that's just super high genetic cholesterol. In fact, there's kids who – I have one gene that's defective, one gene that's good. If both are defective, then your cholesterol is like 1,200, 1,300.
Jeez.
So kids, they're getting like dialysis for cholesterol or bypasses or angioplasties at 10, 11, 12. So mine was genetically based. Wow. So, I mean, you guys didn't glaze over so far.
No, we're not glazing over at all. Because I do believe that there's a, you know, like maybe it is weaving in the characters of the people surrounding you while this was happening, and the doctor and the tech and the and telling the story that way and using those to paint the colors. But I do feel like it's really I do think it is very interesting, and it's very human. It's very humanizing.
Yeah, I've talked about it over the years and done a lot of benefits with him, with PK Shaw, and talked about it. And yeah, maybe I'll do the next special.
Oh, do you want to do another special?
Oh, I do, definitely, yeah. I really want to do one in a very small room.
Do it in Mill Valley has a great theater.
That's where we were raising the kids. I live a block from that theater.
That is a gorgeous theater.
That's maybe the best theater in the country.
It's great.
In terms of just this compression or feng shui of a room.
Yeah.
Like, I've never bombed in there. It's weird.
Have you guys been to the Mill Valley?
No.
It's an old movie house, and it got restored, and it's... It's a really great space.
It's just this compression. You know, it's all this height of the stage, the demographic of the audience, the vibe of the room. But yeah, that's a magic room.
Yeah, I
love that. You know, didn't you just do one, or you?
I did one. Yeah, I did one. I did it at the Palace of Fine Arts.
When?
In January. It just aired in April. It just came out.
And where is it? Where is it? Where can I get it?
Well,
now that I know you.
Oh, well.
But is it on Showtime or HBO or
Netflix? Comedy Central. It was Comedy Central.
Comedy Central.
And so I guess it's on iTunes and That Comedy Central doesn't – Viacom doesn't have a deal with Netflix, and so it's not on Netflix.
I know. I can't. Spade and Dennis did one. I couldn't find theirs for a year. I go to Comedy Central on demand. It's not there. And Brad Williams is a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
He did one on Showtime.
Yeah.
I can't find it.
Yeah,
I texted him. He was in China. I go, where can I find your special? I go, is it not on Showtime on demand? Nope.
I don't know then. Yeah, it's I'd say iTunes is usually a good fallback, or Amazon. iTunes or Amazon is good.
How did you feel about this one personally?
I felt happy with it because it was just in sort of talking about serious things. It was the result of about 4 years of touring.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, I started, you know, telling all these stories about my dad, which he loved, and then he died. And so then I started talking about that. And so there was this whole arc of dead dad stuff that I was trying to make human and not bum people out and also not make feel like a one-man show.
Right.
Still,
no,
like,
it's
what's
a challenge.
What's so human about this?
Yeah.
So there really is a through line. So there's a lot of, you know, 15-year-old dick jokes to pad the fact that there's a lot of, like, my dad died.
Right.
So I don't think it feels super heavy or like, ooh, you know, there's not a – like, I saw Julie Sweeney's God Said Ha when she was doing it live, and it was an amazing show.
Right.
But it had a lot of those moments where you're like, oh, my God, you know, because it was just such a tragic but beautifully done thing. I don't think there's a lot of, like, heavy tragedy in it, but there is a lot of, you know.
Yeah. Well, my dad died a week before I shot the special.
Really?
Yeah. But he was 92 and, you know.
Yeah, he had it coming.
Right? Well, I did a bit about him for years, and it's really just between the lines if people can see where the darkness was of it. But it was, I said, the last time I talked politics with my father, he said, I can't talk politics with you because you don't know shit. And that's all you need to know about my childhood. Will you be in my audience next time I shoot?
Absolutely.
But that was a rhythm. That's what you're talking about. That's the rhythm of my father became a caricature of his rhythm. But just talking like this, oh, God damn it. Like, you know, when he was 75, you know how older men dressed in pastels?
Yes.
Bright colors. So he came out with a yellow shirt and pink pants. I go, you have pink pants. He goes, they're salmon, you little dummy. So it was a fun rhythm to do. But he had a good life. I mean, he lived till 92. He basically died of old age in no pain.
Good.
So, you know, what can you say?
The way to go.
That is the best way to go.
Yeah.
That is the way to go. But so anyway.
What was your SNL audition that you said was terrifying?
I'd auditioned twice before in the early 80s. Always got I followed Sam Kennison at the Comedy Store at midnight. This was maybe 83.
Oh shit.
With no host. You'd go up and do five and then come off.
Tag
the original
team,
room. And so Kennison elevated the room, and then I went up and played to dead silence. Dead silence. So then, you know, I'd auditioned. They saw me at the Improv. Saw me there. So then they came around again, and after the 85 cast, most of them got fired. So my manager knew Bernie Brillstein and knew Lorne Michaels. So Lorne was going to come see me, and I thought, I can't do it at the Improv at the Comedy Store. I'm going to bomb in the kind of lineup thing. So Rosie O'Donnell was playing a place called Igby's on the West Side.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Which is now a strip club.
Is it? Oh, funny. Yeah. Well, it was like 100 seats, really nice, low ceiling. And I had never met Rosie, but I asked Jan Smith, who ran the club, could I come in there and do a regular set? And he asked Rosie. She said, okay. So we were going to co-headline, and I'd never met her. She seemed incredibly confident, but we were like, who should go on first? So I went on first, but it was a regular audience, and I was going to get 45 minutes. So Lorne Michaels is coming. I'm just incredibly in shape at this point, like you're talking about. I've done 2 years just pounding stand-up. But unbelievably tense. And then I'm waiting to go on. Then Lorne walks in. And he's got Cher with him. And the president of NBC. And they sit down.
Was that Brandon Tartikoff?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they sit down. And now Dana Garney. And it was a good audience. I was in good enough shape. I had chopped broccoli at the church lay. I had a few impressions. Robin Leach, you know. And that basically got me the show. But because I was in an environment where I could make it happen a little bit.
Did you find the SNL environment fertile for comedy, or was it as cutthroat as some people describe?
I don't say cutthroat. I just say that any sociological experiment, you take 10 or 15 comedians and just put them in a free-for-all, and each week you don't know. Because all your well-meaning friends, if you're on a show a lot and then not on it the next week, your friends go, they fucked you, man. They're totally fucking you. What? So it's a bitterness machine.
Yeah.
What happened to me was Church Lady got on the first show and was the final sketch on the first show and then was moved up. And it was then all of a sudden the first sketch on the first show. I'd never done sketch comedy anywhere, ever. I had a really hard time not, when I was in a sketch, not looking at the audience when I got a laugh.
Oh, of course, of course.
Like a stand-up. I didn't know I was in the cold opening. I didn't know what sketch, dress, you know. But I knew that character from my stand-up. And the minute I said, well, isn't that special? And got this enormous laugh, I went, I'm in, you know. So that character exploded, and I had Phil and Jan, Phil Hartman and Jan Hooks, brilliantly playing all these different religious figures who were flailing in the culture at that time. You know, and they were, you know, Tammy
Faye,
Jim Baker.
Yep.
And so that became a big thing. So I had such a foothold on that show because of that right away that I was not behind the eight ball wondering, you know, am I going to get fired or whatever?
Well,
that changed it for me.
Having the audience there is because then when you guys – is it true that the first cut of Wayne's World was like 40 minutes or something and you guys had to go shoot a bunch more stuff?
No, but it was pretty brief. We shot it in 30 days. It was my only good time on a movie set because Penelope Spheeris would just say, what are you going to do here? And I said, well, Garth's going to do this, or he's going to hold this up and go, if you're going to spew into this. He goes, okay. And then there'd be a take. So we could do it slightly faster. That was the only direction.
Oh, wow.
And they let us in the editing room. The whole Foxy Lady thing was not going to make it. It was way over edited, and the whole conceit of it was lost, you know. Because usually when the shyest guy in town tries to be extroverted, he goes way over the top.
Right.
That was sort of what I was thinking underneath, you know. And I was going to do What's New Pussycat. But Steve Martin was doing that in Father of the Bride.
Yep.
So then I switched to Hendrix.
Fucking Steve again!
But that thing was done really fast on the fly. It was light, smooth, and easy. And then the second movie was just poisoned by the first movie. The first movie made fun of product placement and money and power. The second movie, like, if you hand a set director $1 million, they're going to give you $1 million set. They're not going to go, it only took $200,000.
Right.
I walked into their lair. I go, this is Wayne and Garth's, like, place they hang out? And it was this $1 million wooden giant. Yeah. We had a fireman's pole. What the fuck? The first movie is so sweet and innocent.
Cursed by your success.
Exactly.
It was almost the same thing that made Deadpool so huge was that you guys were the first in the early 90s to sort of – the movie was really a commentary on culture and
every
comedy.
Every second we were commenting on ourselves.
Yeah. And no one had really at that point nope, people had, just didn't do that. And it's so commonplace now, but at the time, 80s comedies weren't, they were not self-aware in that way at all. It was the first time where comedy sort of in film was like, oh, this is a thing, this is a whole structure, and we're going to make fun of that.
Right. We're going to point out what we're doing as we're doing it, and you're still going to laugh.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it was just an amazing ride.
But how do you know when you're shooting a film? I mean, and you normally have an audience that's giving you the cues of like, this is funny, this isn't funny. So what is that? What is it that you're trusting when the camera's a foot from your face and you're?
Well, I think that you know, the second movie I was terrible for a lot of reasons, but Garth had different rhythms, and sometimes I would push it too hard. But the rhythm that was based on my brother Brad, no exaggeration, maybe you guys all heard this, but my brother Brad, if he was here, he does kind of talk like this, and he holds his mouth like this, and he's got kind of a rhythm like this. Okay, so I think it was nice. So that thing of, you know, excuse me, I'd like to get by right now. So that was what was anchoring that for the film for me. And the reason I did the little six guns, the little stun guns, because Brad was a science nerd. And he told me how it would plausibly be done and what kind of battery pack, you know, that would happen.
Good
there.
Good space work.
But I think that, you know, we had you know, 3 years to practice it on television. We had a ton of catchphrases. And then it was just sheer freaky luck. I mean, the first time Mike and I saw it, we just saw all the flaws at a big screening out in New Jersey. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, I thought my stuff was a disaster. He thought his stuff was a disaster. And we're out to dinner with one of the people from the studio, and they go, it's got Ghostbusters numbers. Let's eat. So I didn't know my life was about to change. I had Ghostbusters numbers. What do you mean numbers? We didn't know previews, whatever. So.
Oh, yeah. And that was a time when TV people did TV and movie people did movies. And if you could somehow cross over, it was this epic thing. I mean, media is also mashed together now, but it was not that way.
Yeah, it was just a freak thing to be part of.
My mother took me to see it. What year did it come out?
91, 90, I think.
91.
Yeah, so first one. And, yeah.
I was 7 years old when it came out, 8 years old, and my mother took me to see it, and I loved it, but I remember asking my mother what a sphincter was, and she just turns and whispers, it's an asshole.
That's Boston.
They don't drink. They don't smoke pot. I mean, it's a very innocent film. And after my career kind of went down, we can talk about that. But I did the show with Louis and Carell and those guys. Got two little kids.
Loved that show.
The Dana Carvey Show?
Yeah.
Is one of the best sketch comedy shows.
I mean, I like A&W Root Beer Presents the Dana Carvey Show. That was my favorite.
We did that intentionally.
The Taco Bell dancing.
We did that intentionally. We got no money from it. Me and Robert Smigler, Louis, we wanted to make fun of the idea of that, which now it's become.
Now it's a thing.
It was sort of a parody of 50s, you know, Chevrolet Presents. But
Colbert and Carell and... And you guys did a Singled Out sketch. I hosted a show called Singled Out.
Oh, I know. I remember watching that show.
You did Ted Kaczynski. It's like, how did they find him? And then he went on.
Wow, what a memory.
Yeah, well, of course. I was the show that I worked on, so that was a big thing for me.
Yeah, the show was really, really cool. It just never belonged on ABC. That was the main.
Skinheads from Maine. It's like the fucking, the sketches
like
on that
show. That was edgy.
The Beatles Anthology Outtakes was great.
I really loved it. I liked it more than SNL because I love doing stuff with an audience, and I love doing stuff without an audience, like little films. When we did the Beatle thing, there was no audience. You know, I'm set for a plonker, you know. I was plonking away. You know. So you could do, and we had an A team of writers. But what I was going to say, just in terms of Wayne's World real quickly, is then I moved the kids up to Northern California. Well, you know, that's it. Career's done. I'll just do stand-up here and there. And I thought, I can just escape it all. I hadn't been around, and so 6 years later. And then the first Halloween, you know, I've got the candy out. It's like a Norman Rockwell little town up there, Mill Valley. And the ding-dong, it opens up, and there's a teenage kid, dressed exactly like Garth. So I guess you can run, but you cannot hide.
Did you, and you felt like... You really did resign yourself to like, well, I guess that's it. I had a good run.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think the fame would stay with me. I just thought it would sort of trundle down and wanted the kids to have a normal life. And then so we went along and I went to one of my kids' lacrosse games up there. And I started hearing that's Garth's kid or that's Dana Carvey's kid. Garth's kid. Hey, Bernie. They're yelling at my kid.
Oh, my God.
So it became a feature of their childhood that they were known as Dana Carvey's kid, even though I thought I'd faded away enough that it would be tamped down, you know. So I was very exotic. I hung out with a lot of bankers. You know, what's up, guys? The market's up. That's cool. I was such an exotic person up there, you know. Eventually, Sean Penn moved in for a while. Hopper played lacrosse with Dex, his son Hopper.
Oh, wow.
And I would see Sean here and there. And Sean was really, because we would do the dad thing where you'd have the big beige khaki shorts and you'd go to the lacrosse game and it's really hot out and they're on the field and it's beautiful grass and you just got dad stuff on, the baseball cap and big baggy shirt. And I remember Sean once over the side, he had the motorcycle boots, jeans, and a motorcycle and a cigarette. He was like the coolest dad on a cell phone, just off the side, green grass everywhere, beautiful kids in their uniforms. Well, that's, you know.
I have to confess, when you said Hopper played lacrosse, my first thought was Dennis. Like Dennis Hopper was playing lacrosse with children. No, that wasn't
for me. But I couldn't hide there. I had a friend who was from Mississippi, lived next door, and he would say that he would inadvertently tell me that I was being watched around town. My friend said he saw you over there, you know, the Gap buying some socks, Dana. He saw you over there. And then he would report that people, so we realized we were being watched until Sean and Robin Wright came in, and then everyone was talking about them.
Took some of the heat off.
Saw old Sean Penn over the movie theater, Dana, walking in there, you know, that kind of thing.
He was seeing a movie, like a person. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, everyone wants to have a show business story about someone they met. There was this one guy who did see Sean Penn at the Gap, and every party he would want to tell the story. So I'm at the Gap, right? And I'm buying socks, right? And I look over at Sean Penn. He's buying socks. And I go, hey, you like socks? Sean Penn goes, everybody's got to have socks. And that was the end of the story. And then an hour later in the party, you'd hear him over in the corner going, everybody got to have socks. You know? So it was a small town, but a beautiful place. Still have the house there. Redwood trees.
You know. It's gorgeous.
So then the kid's going to stand up, so I moved down here.
Where are you? We're all
in West Hollywood. We're just in the center of it.
Nice.
Yeah. Just there's more show business to do. I've never been busier. There's just everything. It just went crazy.
Do you like it still?
Do I not seem to like it?
No, I just want to know because you.
Oh, I wonder.
It's like when you take time off, do you feel? You know, because part of the thing I think that drives comedy is the hunger. You have to have a hunger for something. Maybe it's attention. Maybe it's I got to be the best comic. Or maybe it's, you know, Louis going, I got to release a special every year like George Carlin. But there has to be some kind of hunger. And I think if their hunger isn't there, comedy's just a chore.
I have an intense hunger. I'm very dysfunctional. I mean, what you're not normal. Like most comedians sleep till noon. And say they're going to write a screenplay and a decade goes by. We're not very self-actualized as a group. The ones like Louis and Seinfeld that actually work or people like yourself who actually make giant things happen is amazing. But I just love Quentin Tarantino. I would love to do a very low-budget film. I've shot a lot of stuff, but I've never just put it over the top. That was like that kind of thing, but more comedic in a very dry way.
Yeah.
That would really drive me as a passion that I'd want to do. I like this is really fun. Mm. Like if you could get paid to do this, this is pure fun for me because my ADD, I can just keep going. I still get a kick out of it. I do. I still get a kick out of getting the audience to laugh at a bit that's kind of weird or they wouldn't expect from me. I still get a charge out of that. Like one that I did that was a little edgy was what we need is an ISIS guy with doubts. You know, Bachnar, I don't know, Bachnar. Do you ever get thoughts in your head, Bachnar? I mean, I love the caliphate and everything with the true, but... I don't know. Maybe women could drive. I don't know. Why do we, you know, why do we have to kill the non-believers? Couldn't we get them in a headlock? So stuff like that is fun. It's still a kick. But what's your biggest charge? Is it stand-up still for you personally?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, everything that I've done in the last 15 years or so was, oh, if I do this, maybe people will see it and they'll come out and see me do stand-up. Which is why I still tour and will go for, you know, a month or two without having a day off because I want to tour on Fridays and Saturday nights.
And what kind of rooms do you play and can play?
I made the jump to theaters about a year ago, mm-hmm. and you know, I'm not I'm not at Gaffigan level theaters. Like Gaffigan will
6,000 or Brian Regan.
Regan, yeah, Brian Regan. But Gaffigan will, you know, it's like his numbers are incredible and well deserved. I mean, Gaffigan is one of the best comics of any generation.
Yeah, but I always see Gaffigan. We've added a sixth show.
It's nuts. You know, he'll go. You know what? I think people don't really understand how difficult it is to motivate people to come out and see shows. And so when you hear Gaffigan's numbers, like, oh, he sold 13,000 tickets in Chicago. That is a fucking crazy number of tickets to sell for a show. Like, if you can,
unbelievable.
You know, for a theater, you need 1,200 or 1,500, and that's difficult. But you know, it is. Yeah. So I'm in theaters, but I'm not at the point where it's like, we added a third show. You know,
it's this interesting. Besides the sort of confessional stylistic thing, it's this renaissance of rock stardom that I don't know if it started with Louis, but so many guys now, just like Bill Burr, they're playing Madison Square Garden and they're selling it out or multiple nights in a row. I mean, we've had the phenomenon of Dane Cook or back in the day, Steve Martin or whatever, but it seems like there's more guys out there. I have a theory that maybe it's because it's the one thing that's untouched and everything else can be manufactured and we have, you know, famous people just for being famous, all that. But why? Because when I went back to the Ice House with my kids just to show them, this is what it was, remarkably the same. It was like, wow, this is still the same, where everything else is upside down.
Yeah, I think part of that is, you know, internet culture has really put internet culture and also, I guess, reality television. But internet culture has put a microscope over everything. And I think people, what they really crave is an experience that feels authentic to them. They don't want to feel. Want to feel like they're being lied to, even if they are being lied to, but in it through an authentic filter.
Right.
But I still think that what people gravitate toward now are experiences that don't feel manufactured or don't feel corporate in some way. So something that feels the easiest and, like, you know, the shortest distance to authenticity is like, here's a really horrible thing that happened to me. This is a human story.
Right.
And how did I build jokes around that, you know?
Or even the high wire act, even if you're not even be authentic, you're up there risking everything, you know?
Right.
You know, it's kind of like I don't know. The first they came for fine art in a way where it's all subjective. You can put a dot.
Yeah.
It's just that stand-up, there's no I was doing a bit. I never really got it to work, but it was like there's no robotic, there's no AI stand up yet. You know, like the Jay Leno one or something, or you know, or that of where they scientists do a thing and so they create an artificial being that's it's called the Johnny one,
right?
And it's the ultimate comedy machine.
Jay's a joke for
and
everything.
And he's taking our acts. And, you know, I don't know.
I mean, it's just not. I think it's just a. I mean, I can't imagine doing a different way that I do it. I do think this is kind of a general trend in comedy at the moment.
Yeah.
And there will be a backlash and then like the two-line joke comics will start to come back and then like the simple – and then maybe it'll be something other, you know, prop – like it does go through waves.
Well, I mean even Brian Regan is not really confessional. It's just great observational with his characters. And – Gaffigan, it's kind of like he likes food, but is it that confessional or is it just sort of brilliant?
No, Gaffigan
kind of long.
Gaffigan's kind of like Gaffigan's kind of like a Wikipedia page where he will introduce a topic of like whales or salads,
and then
you will just see every iteration and take an angle on that thing from as many different angles as possible. I mean, he can do 15 minutes alone on one thing,
right?
And it's, you know, when you watch his specials, they really are. You can go, okay, this was 15 minutes on this thing, and then here's another 15 minutes on this thing. And it is remarkable how much he will get every ounce of pulp out of one thing.
It's kind of a sign of most great stand-ups do that.
Yeah.
Get on one top. I remember, didn't Robert Klein do a whole album at the dentist?
Oh, did he?
I think he did, yeah. I think it was basically 45 minutes in the dentist. I remember hearing Seinfeld on XM Radio, and it was 20 minutes at a supermarket. Avocados, what are they for? You know, and just going through every single thing, you know.
Yeah, but Gaffigan, it's not – I don't think – Gaffigan's not – he will – you know, he talks about having kids, but he's not super autobiographical in the sense where I don't think he would go, oh, who is Jim really? You know, it's like he's just funny. Like he's just funny.
I mean, for me, I would think of things I could think of, but, you know, I've been married for 34 years. Like, is that constructive in my relationship if I although I do some bits about it. But, you know, there's a line where, like, would I possibly hurt my wife's feelings? And I'm not capable of doing the joke.
No. No, if you asked her, I mean, if you have to set up ground rules, like, is this okay or is this not okay? I talk about my fiance a little bit, but I would always clear with her first, like, is this too, can I not talk about this or can I talk about this?
Yeah, my wife just laughed at it because I said the divorce rate for people in their 50s is quadrupled in the last decade because science will not let us die. Like, you're there in your 50s, you've been married 25 years and you're thinking, really? 3 more decades?
Yeah. You know?
And I say, in the best marriage, even the best marriage, at one point you look over and you'll say to yourself, not my best choice. But she finds all that really funny because we know those thoughts go through our minds.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah.
You're just like this. The way for a marriage to last, because you're about to get married, maybe, you know, is that you just accept the idea that it's a roller coaster. And then if you have a flat few months, you don't bail out. You wait for it to come back. And then when it comes back, you go, wow, I'm so glad I didn't jump.
Mm. Well, yeah, because I think people...
Unless it's a horribly abusive relationship. You're being beaten on them. Can I show you something related to the heart thing?
Sure. Mm. What is that? What'd you do?
That's some bruise.
Well, because I'm on Plavix, I took a tumble off a stage, the Lab Improv. I was doing a podcast with my kids.
Yeah?
A little tiny step. And I was just watching them come up, and I just fell.
That is an insane – I wish people could see this. It really does kind of look like a weather map.
The top quarter of Dana's arm is
my
black
wife
and
takes
blue.
Pictures of them because I'm thinking of making art out of them. I mean, I think they're very, very cool.
You should start an Instagram page of just bruises.
Well, because they're kind of artsy, right? There's green and purple.
Do they hurt or is it just
– No, not at all. I could do the tiniest bump that, you know. But anyway.
You feel good in general, though.
I feel fantastic. I'm incredibly fit. I would challenge any comedian, literally any comedian, to try to hike with me up in Griffith Park.
Rogan.
From the bottom to the top. Oh, he wouldn't have a chance. I mean, I couldn't fight him, but I would dominate him so bad on the hills just because I'm a lightweight.
You're light. You know? Yeah, that's right. You can scale.
Yeah, it doesn't mean
spry.
No. I don't want to make Rogan mad, but he
Rogan
could.
Smash.
He could kill me with it. With
he's such a sweetheart, though. He'd never kill you. He's a sweetheart.
Oh, I know.
I hope you do a podcast. We should also mention Secret Life of Pets, which is the movie. Did Louis write Secret Life of Pets?
No, I don't think so. No, no.
He's in it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, Louis's in it.
Yeah, Chris Meledandri, who produced a movie called Opportunity Knocks, a horrible movie.
I remember Opportunity Knocks.
Of course I remember Opportunity Knocks.
Way too much fighting. And, you know, but a few things snuck in. But that was, anyway, Chris Meledandri produced that, so he always wanted to do animation with me. When I was up there, I was just on the road and doing the kid thing a lot, so I turned down Ratatouille, which was kind of a mistake because Pixar is brilliant, but I went over there, met with him, and it was a French rat right during the Gulf, the Bush War. I saw a French rat, really? You know, I thought, this isn't going to work, you know? And then it ended up brilliant.
Were you bothered by that when the movie came out and it did really well? Were you like, oh, fuck? Or do you go, you know, I did what I did. I made the choice.
No, you know, because I truly think Patton Oswalt would be better at it. Like, I'm good, like, if I do a voice, but my voice is so neutral. He, like, has a cool voice.
Right.
So I thought he was great. I didn't really feel bad. I turned down Madagascar. So when this one came around, he goes, well, I'd like you to do one of the dogs. I was like, okay, yes, I'll do it. You know. And then he always loved the grumpy old man character. It was kind of a Lionel Barrymore. He used to do an SNL.
Yeah.
You know, Kirk and Smigel wrote it. You know, just one of these guys, you know. I don't know what you're saying. You know, what are we doing here, that guy? So we played around with a few voices, and then that became the character. So the dog is paralyzed and has wheels for, you know.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, just the sweet, lovable, grumpy old dog. Yeah.
What is the release date of Secret Life of Pets?
It is July 8th.
July 8th.
From Illumination, great company.
After celebrating America, you can go out and see Secret Life of Pets.
I've never been in a movie like this because even Wayne's World didn't promote like this. Like everyone I mentioned, oh yeah, Secret Life of Pets. I've never been in something that has like a 300.
There's billboards everywhere
and everything everywhere. I mean, it's saturation, so it's kind of cool.
It is, and also it is kind of funny that you, I think when you've been in the business for a very long time. I think the takeaway is like, yeah, you don't ever know. You don't ever know what's going to hit, what's not going to hit. I mean, you must have worked on stuff before. You're like, this one's going to be, and then it didn't. You're like, oh, I guess not. And then the opposite experience.
Never really happened to me. I except Wayne's World being a big success shocked me. But every other movie, I mean, when I was doing Trapped in Paradise, I went to the dailies and, well, oh, it's it's over. I did in many movies, Clean Slate too. I went, oh, okay, it's a disaster. And then I would look at the brain trust. There would be these three people that, and they were bent over laughing and went, oh, it's over. We're done.
Now, did you take away anything from that? Like, oh, should I listen to different people, or did you like
trust my instincts? Yeah. I basically just stopped. At a certain point, I just stopped. I had a lot of other things, and I kind of went the other way. Like, Bad Boys was supposed to be for me and Lovitz.
Yeah.
And I had a $3 million pay or play. You know, Katzenberg had given me $500,000, but I gave it back when I saw the script because I thought, well, this won't work for me, because they wanted to make me into Will Smith. They were going to add 2 inches to my chest. They wanted to put me in a weight machine and make me the stud. So that one. Hans and Franz, The Girly Man Dilemma was another one that once Arnold dropped out, that one kind of went away. Yeah. Tucson was a comedy western I wrote with Bob Odenkirk. I just kind of stopped because I always had stand-up. You know, it was too torturous to do when you knew that the sensibility was not matching. But when I did the show with Louie and Smigel, that was just fun, except for that you only made 8 episodes because I was with the A-team and we had all the same sensibility. But if you're doing anything with well-intended, bright people, but if you just aren't on the same page, it's very painful.
Yeah.
You know, very painful. You know.
Well, I hope, number one, we should talk after the podcast so we can – because if you guys are in the side of town you're in, you should come to Meltdown, which is an amazing place to...
I was there once on... Dan Harmon invited
Harmontown,
me over.
You do Harmontown?
I did, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a great room for stand-up, and especially with if your kids are doing... Like, it's just a good room.
Oh, it was amazing. That's like a rock and roll, because they were so close and the ceilings are so low.
Yeah.
It's all that compression. Like,
it's intimacy.
There's nowhere for the energy to go.
Yeah.
And it makes everyone focus.
That's why I don't understand arena comics. I mean, I understand Steve Martin. I mean, his style of comedy and that blew up in the 70s when that was still. But when people now like want to do arenas, I really don't get it, because it's such an
intimate.
Didn't
Kevin Hart just do a football stadium?
Kevin Hart sold out. It was like 55,000
Atlanta,
tickets,
right?
I thought it was in Massachusetts.
I heard. I don't know if it's true that he's playing Nebraska.
He's playing the whole state.
Yeah, the state.
He's got a platform. Sold it out.
He sold it.
He's going to play. Sold out the state.
One night only.
Right. Yeah. He's releasing it as a movie.
He's releasing it as a movie. Oh, he is. You know about this?
Nice.
You know, whoever wants to do that is fine. You know,
but if you're 50 rows back, like, comedy is so intimate. At that point, it's really just let's go see a famous guy, or let's go see a famous lady, because you're just a person's tiny on stage, and there's no. I feel like you need an audience to be able to. I think 3,000 is about the number where the audience starts to fall apart into sections. Any bigger than that? And then it's just like, okay, the loge liked that one. Okay, this one.
Yeah, it depends on your style. I mean, for me, I'm just very sensitive to what I think the audience is feeling and enjoying. And when I feel like I can't feel what – I just have to kind of turn myself on in a way, like to sort of excite myself. But that's when I went around with the kids. Like I said, I realized, wow, I really like a tight, hot 300-seat club is – that's really fun. But
Punchline.
But a big room is a lot of work.
Yeah, the punchline's great.
Yeah, they're just right there. So, but the bigger you get, you know, how do you like, well, here's $3,200, Mr. Gaffigan, or we can pay you $500,000 for, well, I like the little room better.
Well,
you know,
that's what Chappelle does. Chappelle will just do like, he'll just go to the punchline and just do like a week, you know, and just sell out 2-3 shows at a time, and it's super – it's a pretty – like, that's a really fun –
The image of Chappelle, when you think of him, you think he just does exactly what he wants to do any given second. I don't know if it's true or not. I've met him a few times. But that is a great place to be, and I think that for me, being a variety performer, you can get trapped up in a lot of things. You know, when you're sort of moldable. If you're a singular brand, like, say, John Lovitz, just a style and a rhythm, you plug it in. And when you're a variety performer and kind of a mush-faced Irish-looking guy, you know, it's like, hey, should we make him the nice guy? Or is he going to do a character? Or what is he going to do? So it's led to a lot of confusion. So anyway, my thing now is just to be authentic is the word of the day.
Yes.
And do what I want to do. I am enjoying it for the most part. And, you know, really, which is so profoundly emotional for me, is watching my kids go through the struggle and when they do well. And all the cynicism was just beaten out of me when they were just doing push-ups. And when you walk into the club with them, it's like the Land of Oz, like it was for us, and you see from their point of view. And then at the improv, they come back and they go, "Who's going on first? You know, would you like any music?" Everything is tightening them up. I go, "Guys, do laps around the parking lot. You know, the show's about to begin. Are you guys ready?" And I see it from their point of view. It's this magic, adrenaline fueled thing. And so I got back in touch with that by being around them.
Oh, that's awesome! I'm glad to hear that.
But mostly, I'm just when a joke lands for them or they're excited. That's really, really intense for me right now.
And if they have a bad set and they come off stage, you can just scooch away from them in the booth just to let.
I've seen them start to unravel and getting heckled, and it's getting a little tense, and I just have to leave.
You because it's your kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't stay. I can't stay in the room. Yeah.
Because you want to, you know, the person
they want to leave too.
They want to leave too. But then the taskman, "Oh, Jesus Christ, you can't even go on stage, you little shit. God damn it, you big dummy. You just do a joke. God damn it." It's a funny character, isn't it?
It's a funny character.
It's a funny rhythm, and it's coming totally from him.
By the way, I was going to ask you, did you grow up in San Mateo?
San Carlos.
Okay.
My dad taught at San Mateo High School.
My dad was from San Mateo.
Really? Wow. No one talks about San Mateo.
So my dad was everyone's tired of hearing this, but haven't heard it yet. My dad was one of the greatest professional bowlers in the history of the sport, and he grew up bowling at Bel Mateo Bowl.
Wow. Well, I've definitely been there.
I assumed you had been, wow. So I just didn't.
What's the best score you've ever bowled?
Me? Yeah. 289.
289?
But I was 11. And then I quit bowling when I was 13. And then I kind of started again a few years ago, but yeah. I grew up in a bowling center. Like, my life was growing up in a bowling center. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I bowled every day of the first 13 years of my life.
Did you have like incredibly strong legs or back or something? It seems like some kind of lopsided.
You know what I did have though?
Arm,
I had this kind of like weirdly developed muscle
that
right,
would be it.
Right here
and it stayed.
From hooking the ball. Yep, that's what
that
is.
Wow, that's interesting. So your dad was a professional bowler.
Yeah.
Did he come home and throw things around and rage? I mean, it seems like such a, you know, 9-1 split. I mean, was he on the road every second then?
He was on the road a lot, and it's kind of funny when I'm on the road as a comic how I'm like accidentally mirroring his life. Like when he was still alive, I'd be in a town, and I'd be like, "Hey, I'm in Phoenix, and there's a bowling center here. Do you know this bowling?" "Yeah, you know, in 68, I went through there, and we bowled, and we got really drunk and drove into a cactus." Like, he had a story for every bowling center. So I kind of had this weird parallel life of being on the road. Like
interesting.
Was.
Yeah, I was just thinking about being a pro. I mean, the tension of that. I remember watching on ABC, Wild World of Sports. Yeah, just very tense.
Seventh frame.
So that's where you got your fearlessness from.
I don't know. Yeah. I think a lot of it came from my dad's dad was kind of a tyrant, and he just left home at like 17 to present. His father was kind of the same. Like, he would say the same kind of things. You know, my dad would go, "Oh, I'm going to open a bowling center. What are you doing that for? You're too stupid to run a business." It was like a lot of that.
Yeah. I was always the underdog, and I was my mom's favorite. She called me precious. My dad couldn't stand me, and I was just the littlest kid in class, and you know, just very shy. So, yeah, Revenge of the Nerds. Right?
Revenge of the Nerds, yeah. And then you get to sort through that stuff for the rest of your life. It's kind of fun.
I know. Everyone has a therapist. I don't know whether to go to Conan's or or Bob Saget's. I get recommendations.
I feel like Saget would have – Saget's really – He's got that one on lockdown. Like, he's just like, "Oh, I got Saget from noon to 8. You can come in and do it. And I say that I adore Saget. He's one of the sweetest,
nicest, most wonderful, loyal people
in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, this is really cool. I like the way you guys do this.
Well,
like,
thanks.
Because I like the way it didn't start.
Doesn't start.
And say, "Now we're talking." I was not introduced.
Doesn't end either.
The reason you don't. Yeah, we're here for.
And now you edit till midnight.
The reason that I don't is because I think people who are used to being interviewed, when they hear it starting, the shields go up and they're in a mode.
You're totally right. But most people aren't that smart. That's just simple math.
And I would rather just have people very relaxed and they're kind of open before they realize what's happening. And then it's not like, "We are starting the thing." That's why I don't ever have video in here either, because I don't want people to feel like I have to perform.
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, this has been really fun and really relaxing. But, yeah, I'd have to come back again to be totally relaxed because my mind is absorbing so much information.
Yeah.
I'm observing so much things about this room that's very stimulating.
Well,
Asperger's kind of way.
You're welcome to come back.
And so then, you know, it's kind of like, then you know, It's just like stand-up. I mean, the more you do it, the more you get out of your own headspace.
I would love
you guys did it great because it was very easy.
I would love to just now that we're – oh, we have to say enjoy your burrito. We end the podcast. We say
Secret Life of Pets, July 8th.
July 8th is a film called Secret Life of Pets.
Better than Finding Dory. Better than Finding – because everyone's thinking about it. So long, Zootopia. Farewell, Finding Dory. I hope you find her. We're on our way to $1 billion.
This time's the animals talking as the dogs.
Yes.
They're like humans. That's why it's so funny. They can talk and run and maybe drive a car. Sorry, I don't even know where that comes from. The demented Hans.
That's the guy who's just explaining what all the CG animated films
well,
are
he's
about.
He's just better than everybody. It's almost back to feminine Hitler.
We end the podcast by saying enjoy your burrito, which is just a sort of mantra that says enjoy the present. Would you mind saying it for us? Would you sign
enjoy,
it?
Enjoy. Oh, what you gotta do, man? You get a burrito. You gotta have it. You gotta eat it. It's time what you do, man. It's time what you do, huh? Enjoy the burrito, okay?
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Every year, 50 teenage girls, one from every state, show up in Mobile, Alabama to compete in the largest cash scholarship competition exclusively for high school girls. They spend months training to win the big prize. But what happens when a Supreme Court decision leaves many of them feeling unprepared for the real world?
A lot of the girls were crying, and I never seen any of them cry before.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shima Oliai. Follow me behind the scenes as all 50 girls are catapulted into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. What do they think of their changing country? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.